is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. In just a few minutes, President Obama will be holding a news conference. We will go to Washington for coverage as soon as the news conference begins. The president is expected to talk about the partial shutdown of the government and the upcoming debt ceiling deadline. But first, at one time, people suffering from mental illness were locked up in institutions, some against their will. That changed a few decades ago, but it also left many to fend for themselves on the streets. Locally, more than 30% of the homeless suffer from some form of mental illness. Today, we're going to talk about the problem and what some are doing to help. Joining me are psychiatrist and chief medical officer of Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, GBC Homeless Services Manager Debbie DeMarcus, and Strategies to End Homelessness Executive Director Kevin Finn. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to start out talking about how severe the homeless mental illness problem is in Greater Cincinnati. And maybe, Dr. Scale, you can start out and tell us how many people really is it affecting?
Well, I deal with the homeless team that we have in GCB since 2005. I'm the psychiatrist that sees all the people with homelessness and mental illness in the area. So numbers-wise, I think I'm going to defer to Debbie and Kevin on that, but I'll tell you it's much more than you would imagine, and people are very, very ill. Debbie, do you have a statistic on that?
Well, last year, there were over 7,000 people that were homeless and living outside on the street or in shelters. Roughly about 34% of all of those had a mental illness.
And how that sort of breaks down depends on who you're talking about. Like Debbie mentioned, we had 7,013 people on the street and in shelter last year. 34% overall were mentally ill. But if you just look at the people who were sleeping on the street, it's actually 63% of the people that were mentally ill.
That's an enormous number.
Yes, it is.
That's an enormous number.
Frequently, it's their mental illness that is a big factor in why they are out on the street as opposed to residing in one of our shelters.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. It's sort of like the chicken and egg theory. What really does come first? Does the homelessness in any way cause mental illness, or does the mental illness cause homelessness?
We also manage, at Strategies to End Homelessness, we also manage homelessness prevention services. And the people we see in prevention who aren't quite there yet, but unfortunately might be on their way, look very similar to the people who are homeless. We had 38% of the people in our homelessness prevention program were mentally ill, 34% of the people who are homeless. So clearly it is a big factor in why people end up on a track that could take them to homelessness. In addition, then, very often, if the shelters and facilities we have aren't prepared to deal with the mental illness, that is why a person who is mentally ill might be more likely to actually end up out on the street and then not even provided with the safe environment that a shelter could be for them.
Dr. Scale, what is it about mental illness that causes people to get into a situation where they may end up being homeless?
There's so many mental illnesses that we see represented on the team. So, for example, someone with schizophrenia, which is a psychotic disorder, they might be so disorganized that they really can't maintain their day-to-day functions. They don't attend to their hygiene, or maybe they're in an apartment and they can't take care of the apartment. They end up getting evicted, ended up on the street. So sometimes it's the disorganization part, or maybe they're very disruptive to the other tenants and there's complaints and the landlord can't tolerate that. Another man that we ended up on the homeless team, bipolar disorder. This is not an atypical scenario at all. Had a so-called normal life, wife, kids, good job. Clearly had a manic episode at some point, became out of control with his temper, challenging the boss, ended up having affairs, overspent. In the process, lost the wife and kids, lost the job, was in debt up to his eyeballs and started writing bad checks. You do enough of that, you have a felony charge. And our team found him living in a car in downtown Cincinnati. So that was bipolar disorder. We see a lot of depression. And we're seeing a lot more of trauma, too. Besides the major mental illnesses, we're seeing a lot of people that have had horrific abuse histories in their past, and now they don't have any education, they have an impoverished background, and maybe they were living with some abusive boyfriend who now kicked them out on the streets, and we're seeing them as well.
Will the severity of the mental illness really make a difference? I assume there are minor mental illnesses and more serious or more severe mental illnesses. Is that true?
I tend to think of it that way. So we think of severe mental illness, schizophrenia, severe bipolar disorder. Some people with depression can be incredibly depressed and suicidal and sometimes can have psychotic features. So some of those people tend to do the worst, or some of our patients who are psychotic end up being shunned, or the people that you see on the side of the road and people will walk across the street to avoid them. Some of them have a very, very difficult time. Some of the other people that are more just down on their luck end up being a lot more savvy maybe, and they know how to access the shelters or neighbors and things like that.
I think that points to just how complicated of an issue that it is, because everything Dr. Scale said is true. But at the same time, some of the systems in place change that dynamic. So, for example, historically, to get mental health case management services, you had to be not just mentally ill, you had to be severely mentally ill. And that means that we have many people who might be mentally ill enough for it to lead to them to become homeless, but not mentally ill enough to qualify for many of the services that are available in the community. So you end up with a dynamic where severe mental illness could be the cause of someone's homelessness, but then also not being severely mentally ill enough can, in a backhanded way, lead to someone not being eligible for services that could have prevented them from becoming homeless.
So what can be done in terms of prevention if you have a family member? I mean, I'm assuming mental illness doesn't just start when you become an adult. This starts, in many cases, as a child, a teen.
Well, there's some screening efforts going on now in primary care offices, screening for depression, screening for trauma. So the primary care physicians can actually identify people at an early stage and try to get them assistance and mental health treatment.
Dr. Scale?
That is true. And we try to wrap around services as soon as we see anything happening to that person. So whether that means it's a school system and the guidance counselor is getting involved, or there's some community supports, or they're now in the adult system and they can access. Kevin, your point is fantastic about that. You're right. Typically, the person does have to be severely mentally ill enough to access services. We'll see what happens now with Medicaid expansion potentially going through. If more and more people will have access to Medicaid, then they will not have to have schizophrenia to access services. They could have
that
a
is something
depression.
That might very much change the dynamic.
So how likely is that to happen? I mean, how likely is it to get those people what they need?
I think your guess is probably better than ours, because you're probably more dialed into some of the politics around that issue. But clearly, Medicaid expansion would bring services to many people who experience homelessness who are not currently eligible to receive either medical or mental health services.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking today about the mentally ill among the homeless. My guests today are psychiatrist and chief medical officer of Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, GBC Homeless Services Manager Debbie DeMarcus, and Strategies to End Homelessness Executive Director Kevin Finn. You can join the discussion by calling us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Before the president began his talk, we were talking about the problem with a number of people who are not getting the treatment they need, which is how they end up on the streets, and the likelihood of getting that treatment. Is it available under normal health coverage, health insurance policies for people that are in a family with working parents and maybe a child has some mental illness? Is that usually covered?
The child system is a little bit different for me, so maybe Kevin, you might want to speak to that. But I know if you have Medicaid actually is very good. You can get very good care, and I'd like to really emphasize that, because I think sometimes people think that if they don't have private insurance or if they aren't very wealthy, that they can't get good care. And you can get fantastic psychiatric care in Hamilton County if you have Medicaid. Medicaid, Medicare, and actually we have a good indigent match. So many of the patients that I see and give the best care I can possibly give are indigent. And many of the people I see on the homeless team are indigent. So they have access to good care. It's a matter of connecting. That speaks to our homeless team, for example. So the PATH team we have, and these care managers go out in the community and they literally are going under bridges and in the woods and on the riverbank and looking for people that are homeless and mentally ill and connecting them with services, whether it's with the drop-in center or tender mercy shelters and with us. So we provide the psychiatric care they need and the care management. And one of the great strengths I think we have in Hamilton County is that we have this housing first model that people can get into housing without jumping through lots of hoops. And Kevin, I'm glad to have met you today to talk to you more about this, because it's been fantastic for me with my patients that they're very ill. They might not want to take medicines or even understand that they need medicines at this point, but that's okay, because we're saying dignity first, safety and shelter first, and then we'll start talking about these other things.
Are meds always the answer? I mean, is that the main way to treat mental illness?
And meds are not always the answer. Meds are sometimes the answer, or they're very helpful. The medications are tools, really. So we want people to be able to think more clearly if they have a disorganization, or if they're very depressed, or they're manic and their thoughts are all over the place. Their medications can be extremely helpful for that. But that's not the only answer. Counseling is often very important. Making sure their overall medical health is important, so we try to connect them with our primary care colleagues. And again, this whole point of being connected to a greater society and having this dignity and safety is so important to them.
We do invite you, if you have questions, to give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Anne wrote in on Facebook and says she has a number of questions, so we're going to take a few of them here. She wants to know, is it better to give money directly when asked, or to support local shelters and other organizations that try to help the homeless?
Well, personally, I've never worked with a homeless individual who has received money from panhandling that has spent that money on food or shelter. Typically, you're enabling a substance abuse problem by giving money. So it would be much better to give that money to programs than it would for an individual to get it.
I always like to say there are two dots that people tend to connect that need to be disconnected. The average homeless person has never panhandled, and the average panhandler is not necessarily homeless, regardless of what the sign says. If the sign they are holding says they are homeless, they probably receive more money. That does not mean they are actually homeless. So again, the average homeless person does not panhandle, and not every panhandler is actually homeless. I would agree with Debbie completely that, generally speaking, the segment of the homeless population that the people that do go out and panhandle, generally speaking, they are supporting a habit.
Well, Anne also asks then, what is the polite, safe response when approached for money? And then what is the best way to help a person if there are some issues there?
I generally speaking will ask people what they want the money for. Typically the answer is to get something to eat or something like that. I might offer them something to eat rather than money.
And what's the response you get from that? Do they go get a sandwich, or do they
It depends from person to person. But I mean, if you want to be sure that what you're doing is giving somebody something to eat, then give them something to eat.
And typically, I'll let people know about Greater Cincinnati Behavioral's outreach team, the PATH team that Dr. Scale mentioned. We have an office that people can drop into. So instead of giving them money, I'll just maybe offer a resource to them.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the programs that are out there if people do have troubles. Perhaps you know of someone who has a mental illness and who is now homeless, or you fear for a family member in that situation. What should you do? Where can you direct these people to go?
Well, our PATH outreach team will work with people who are homeless right now, and also people who are at risk of homelessness. We specialize in assisting people that have mental illnesses, whether they're minor or more severe. We have an office at the McMicken Health Collaborative, which is 40 East McMicken. We have drop-in hours all day long. So those people, the PATH workers, focus on trying to find services for homeless people.
I would also mention that in terms of homeless services, our system does have something called the Central Access Point, or CAP for short, 513-381-SAFE. That is basically a resource and intake line for homeless services and also homelessness prevention services. So CAP could connect people to resources directly, or could refer people to other resources if it's not something available through the hotline itself.
If you happen to be on the street, whether anywhere, downtown or anywhere else, and you see a person who's homeless that clearly does have some mental issues. Is that the type where you need to let a police or an authority member know? Should you just walk away? I mean, what should you do as a caring citizen if you encounter that situation?
That comes up quite a lot, which is nice because there are a lot of caring citizens. So if you see someone that's obviously in distress, maybe not thinking clearly, the police is actually a very good answer. The police are being trained. In fact, GCB is actively involved. We quarterly are training police officers to be more sensitive to mental health issues. And many of them have that certification. They actually shadow and spend time with us. Or any of the mental health agencies, particularly ours, you know, we welcome people to drop in and ask a question to us. Somebody on our staff, we have many, many skilled clinicians that could help figure out the answer to this. The mental health access point, the emergency rooms, Mental Health America, or as Debbie was saying, McMicken, Drop-In Center, Tender Mercies, they would all have resources available.
But I think it's important for people to understand. I think you're absolutely correct that people should not feel like if they were to notify a police officer that what they're doing is getting that homeless person thrown in jail. Quite the contrary. Cincinnati police have been really great in recent years in working with the street outreach workers that work in Hamilton County and specifically in the city, such as the PATH team that GCB runs. The police work very closely with them and will bring in appropriate services to make sure that someone is trying to help them get off the street. They will not simply throw them in jail or something like that.
Right. We've had police bring people to our agency, and I've seen them. So instead of bringing them to jail or maybe even to the emergency room, they bring them to us. I see them, and we were able to de-escalate the situation or see, oh, okay, you know, this is what's going on, and well, this person really needs shelter for tonight or really needs a little bit of medicine or whatever it is they need, and we take care of it.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Leroy's calling from Beachmont. Hi, Leroy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, can you? Yes, my question is, if a person has depression and they were diagnosed with it, how long does it take? I know you cannot diagnose it over the phone, I understand that, but how long does it typically take a normal person to get worse? And if it were to get worse, what are the signs? Because I was diagnosed with clinical depression, anxiety, and some type of slight disorder and anxiety. And it's all getting better, but sometimes it feels like it's not, and I really can't take antidepressants.
Well, that's a good question, Leroy. Thanks for calling in with that. So I'm sorry that you've struggled with that. I'm glad to hear things are getting better. Typically, a depression is it lasts several days to weeks. It's not just you had a bad day or a bad weekend or there was some precipitant that made you upset. This is a sustained period of time that more days than not are you're in a depressed mood or you have something that's called anhedonia, meaning lack of interest in usual pleasurable activities. So normally you really enjoy watching the Bengals, but you're not interested at all. Or you like playing with your grandkids, but you could care less about that right now. That's a big sign of depression. Inattention to things that you normally care about, maybe your hygiene, maybe your sleep has changed, your appetite has changed, energy level has changed, sometimes feelings of helplessness, worthlessness, hopelessness, sometimes thoughts of death, and in extreme cases, thoughts of suicide. Certainly as more of those progress, and especially if there's any thoughts of death involved, definitely seek treatment for that. Antidepressants can be very helpful to some people. Counseling is also very helpful to people. Combination and exercise and good sleep and good nutrition is also extremely helpful.
I think one of the questions he was asking, though, is if you do have a slight case of depression, can it quickly escalate into a situation where you could end up getting to the point of becoming homeless?
Everybody's so different. So typically with a major depression, or we call it recurrent major depression, there's more of an insidious onset. Usually people slink into more depression, but things can happen relatively quickly. So be aware of that. If you have a major depression, and even if you are treated or not treated and it goes away, if you have it again, chances are you are prone to that and you probably should be on something or be in some kind of treatment long term.
Leroy, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you.
We appreciate it. Our number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. I know of a lot of people who have, or at least a number of people who have been treated for some form of depression or other type of mental illness, but don't want to stay on the meds because of the side effects. How severe are these side effects?
It really does depend on the medications. Every time they create a new medication, they keep hoping that there'll be fewer side effects. The antidepressants are notorious for sexual side effects, for example. So people often will complain about that. They start feeling less depressed, but now they still have ongoing sexual side effects, which aren't pleasant for them. So the newer meds keep hoping to avoid that. Some people have gastrointestinal issues or sleep disturbances and things. So again, it very much depends on the person. You want to be on the least amount of medication possible. So sometimes people needed higher dose at one point, but they can go to a lower dose at a later date.
So, and I think some of those side effects point to why we see a real problem with dealing with mental illness among the homeless is that people will come back into the system because the medication, even if it is able to help them with their mental health condition, they may actually get back into housing and different things like that. And they think they are better. And because of some of the side effects, they wish to not be taking the medication anymore. But if they stop taking their medication, then the cycle may repeat itself and they could end up homeless another time.
Good point, Kevin. And there's so many different options now. So I would encourage a person, if they are connected with treatment, to talk to their clinician and say, be open and honest. Say, I really don't like this medication. Are there other options? Because there are. There's so many options available. The other flip side of that, Kevin, that I was thinking about is we have all these people that are homeless, and you really can't, it's very difficult to give medication, even if someone needs it. Say someone's very psychotic and they want medicine. They're hearing voices, and we try to do that. But if you're really living in the park or under a bridge, it's very hard to keep track of your medications, to have access to bathrooms and all these things that you need, and food. Some of the medicines say take with food. You know, it's very difficult for them to do that. So I've had many patients say, Doc, as soon as I get into my apartment, I'll take the medication, because they can't consist, or they'll be too sleepy. Maybe the medicine's going to make them too sedated, and they're sleeping on a bench, and somebody's going to roll them for their money if they're sedated.
It's why I'm a huge fan of prevention in so many different ways. It's like, if we could offer comprehensive mental health treatment, if we can get comprehensive mental health care to a person before they become homeless, then all of those issues that Dr. Scale was just describing become so much easier to deal with. They still have a place to keep their meds. They're still stable in housing. Everything becomes more difficult to address after the person has become homeless, for many of the same reasons that you just described.
And think, Kevin, if they have all these medical problems. We have so many patients that are diabetic, or what if you're insulin-dependent diabetic, and where do you keep your insulin?
Right. A full quarter of our homeless population in 2012, 25%, had a chronic medical condition, so separate from mental illness. So very frequently, the people that are suffering from mental illness are suffering with other conditions as well.
We're talking today about the mentally ill among the homeless. We'll continue the discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We continue our discussion about the mentally ill among the homeless. My guests today are psychiatrist and chief medical officer of Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, GBC Homeless Services Manager Debbie DeMarcus, and Strategies to End Homelessness Executive Director Kevin Finn. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We go now to Mike from Wilmington. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. My question is about those who are homeless, who do live underneath bridges and parks and what have you, but they have been introduced to the criminal justice system, and so they have very, very, how can I say this, difficulties with finding either employment or shelter or even a place to live that would even have them. Most of the time they're turned away from landlords and or even public housing just because of the conviction.
Has that happened a lot? Do you find that people, once they have a conviction, it gets more difficult to find a place to live?
It is definitely difficult.
Yeah, and particularly those, and I don't want to single out any one particular group, but those with sex offenses in Ohio are particularly prone to that homelessness, and they really fall through the loops because they really don't qualify for any public housing. A lot of programs turn them away, especially those if they're coming out to a halfway house, particularly in Cincinnati, they get turned away from those halfway houses. And so basically they're homeless after they leave prison. So,
Kevin, what do you suggest?
Well, one of the things that we do as an organization is we oversee the federal funding to provide services to the homeless. And most of those services are housing services. Now, the feds require that we are offering those housing programs to people coming out of one of two situations. They were either on the street or they were a resident of a shelter. So a person who is coming directly out of prison or something like that, at that moment, they are not eligible for those types of programs. And these are separate from public housing and Section 8 programs most people are aware of. But those programs are targeted at people who are on the street and in shelters. If a person is so unfortunate as to end up in one of those positions, they are eligible for those programs. Something I feel like I need to say, though, is, you know, in Hamilton County on any given, and obviously our callers from Wilmington, which is a different area, but in Hamilton County on any given night, we have about 750 people who are on the street or in a shelter. Contrary to what most people believe, the reality is that 675 to 700 of those people are in a shelter. The vast majority are in a shelter. It is actually a relatively small percentage. Only 1 out of 7 of our homeless people in 2012 was encountered on the street. So there are shelters available to people. The average homeless person actually is in a shelter. The caller does make a very good point, though, in that there are no shelters in Hamilton County which can knowingly take in a sex offender. So the population of sex offenders is a particularly difficult population to address because the shelters can't take them. People with other felonies, though, can enter the shelter system.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. What role do the courts play in all of this and those sorts of situations? You talk about there's no place for sex offenders to go. Is it safe to say then many of the people that you're going to find sleeping on the streets are the sex offenders?
It is a real catch-22, and I would ask Debbie to elaborate on this a little bit too. But because none of the shelters can take sex offenders, and therefore sex offenders can't be registered using a shelter as their address, the current requirements for sex offenders actually force them onto the streets where no one knows where they are. They could be sleeping up against a school, but we put them in a situation where by not providing them with a shelter that they are allowed to go to, we force them in a way out onto the streets. Debbie knows much more about the population that she's engaged with on the street, so...
Yeah, we have found quite a few sex offenders that are forced to live outside. Although if they have a mental illness and we take them onto GCB's homeless case management team, we are able to access Shelter Plus Care subsidies that Strategies to End Homelessness administers. And we've been able to find private landlords that are able to house sex offenders. There are areas that are not within 1,000 feet of a school. Right. And so we are able to access housing. And
so there are housing programs we can make available to them, but they become very difficult to locate because we do not have a shelter that is able to take them in.
We go now to Laura from Warren County. Hi, Laura. What's your question?
Well, I don't have a question. I have a comment. I have a son who is adopted. I adopted him at birth, my husband and I. He's now 12, but his birth mother was homeless at the time, and his birth father was also homeless. He was recently diagnosed with bipolar, however. His birth parents were not technically diagnosed with a mental health illness in their documents, however, so I find it interesting with this high percentage of mental health illnesses with these people, you know, that are homeless.
So what is your, you just wanted to mention that that does happen, and obviously you're having the results of that then with your adopted son?
Right, exactly.
Dr. Scale?
I find it fascinating. Mm-hmm.
And bipolar disorder is one of the most highly genetically transmissible illnesses across the board of all illnesses. So the chance that one or both of his biological parents might have had bipolar disorder or some kind of mood disorder is very high. And like you said, for two parents to be out homeless, unless there was some kind of financial thing that happened and they ended up down on their luck, if they just met on the street and they were both out there, maybe one of them, one or both, had mental illness.
Laura, thanks for your call. We go now to Ben from Westchester. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
What's your question?
I kind of have two questions. The first is that I myself have been involved in a mental environment. I was accepted due to having high levels of anxiety, and I went to a hospital where they took care of me for a couple weeks. I was just curious, though, have you guys ever thought about the possible idea that the environment itself goes ahead and makes someone, have a mental illness? And then, secondly,
you mean the environment where they're being treated?
Where they're capped at. Yeah, where they're being treated. I'm just curious. I mean, I'm not...
Dr. Scale?
Oh, that's a great question. And I just had that conversation with one of my own patients yesterday who said, I think I just want to go into the hospital. And he was doing sort of okay for him. And I said, really, you really don't want to go into the hospital right now unless things are very extreme for you. At this point, for good or for bad, the hospitals are pretty much for people that are very, very ill and imminent risk. They're imminent risk of harming themselves, somebody else, or they're very, very psychotic. So I have had patients come back from a hospital setting who said it was such a revved up, anxious environment in there that they felt overstimulated and stressed out by being there. It just depends. If you need it, you need it, though.
It's interesting, too, in relation to homelessness that, if a person had depression prior to becoming homeless, certainly becoming homeless does not help with that. So the issue of being homeless can make a mental health condition actually worse. I would say the same with substance abuse, that sometimes people may have had a not severe substance abuse issue, but upon becoming homeless, that clearly makes it worse.
Ben, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. We just have a couple seconds left. We did have an email from someone who has a son in another town. The son is homeless and mentally ill, but will not take meds. Wants to know, how can you convince someone to stay on their meds? Apparently, he also won't take advantage of any services.
I think the final thing I would say with that is never, never give up hope on this. You just have to keep trying. And, sometimes they just have to hear it for the thousandth time or in a different way, or somebody else says it. But please never give up hope, because we've seen time and time again people that were in the same situation and we've seen fantastic results.
And a best practice being implemented is various types of housing first programs where there
yes.
are no preconditions to engage in services.
Right.
We're out of time. Thank you. A slightly abbreviated show with a presidential news conference in the middle of it. We appreciate you being here today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to Cincinnati Edition. We've been talking about mental illness among the homeless. My guests were psychiatrist and chief medical officer of Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, GBC Homeless Services Manager Debbie DeMarcus, and Strategies to End Homelessness Executive Director Kevin Finn. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike McNich. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds and Rick Andrus.